One of the practices that is emphasized a lot in traditional Buddhist cultures is the cultivation of loving kindness, and is usually encouraged and taught even, say, before people practice meditation, you know, in the sense of even before people take on meditation, there's the encouragement and kind of a high value placed on the that practice of cultivation of loving kindness, and then also it's seen as a kind of a foundational practice for the cultivation of meditation when one is beginning meditation. It's an important quality to set the tone set the scene, set the intention within the mind, within the heart. So to bring that practice of developing and cultivation of loving kindness forward as a kind of an integral part of our practice and training is very important. And so often the practice of meditation is almost seen as something that is separate from those qualities of loving kindness, or it's or isn't really even considered that much at all, or it's sort of seen as some sort of poor cousin to the real practice, which is sort of meditation, but traditionally that's not really how those qualities of loving kindness are viewed. And I think in particular the the way that particularly in Western culture, how there's such a strong inclination to competition, comparing, anxiety, tension, stress, it's actually a really necessary part of practice to really be putting attention onto training of the inclining the heart to loving kindness, and to the practices of metta, and to be very consciously bringing into mind that intention and wish for well-being, both for oneself as well as for others, and to draw that quality in the in the heart that is sort of extends its range of feeling up to well wishing, wish for security, wish for happiness, that wish for quality of safety and to recognize that is very fundamental to the heart, that we all wish that. And so often we miss that. We don't really wish ourselves well. We don't really incline the heart to those qualities of well-being and quality of security and freedom from fear, that we tend to compound that. We tend to compound the sort of anxiety, fear, aversion, So to to start to really pay attention to that and realize that we can, it doesn't change by just letting, say, thoughts of negativity or of stress kind of fester in the mind, in the heart. It changes when we really consciously bring up those qualities of directing attention to kindness, a quality of caring. And by our bringing attention to it for ourselves and towards ourselves, is the first step to really be able to direct that to others. Oftentimes we kind of think that we should be doing it for others, because on an ideal level, or even on a moralistic level, one feels one should be doing that for others, to wish them well, and we don't really investigate, well, what's the seed of that, and we don't. Oftentimes don't see ourselves as worthy enough to really be caring for ourselves, to really be wishing ourselves well, or it feels almost sort of a guilty feeling that comes up that one shouldn't really be wishing oneself well because we're so sort of so flawed that it's not really appropriate. I mean, we don't articulate that. It doesn't come up as an articulated way of how we do that. But why do we we'll start sort of looking. What's the resistance? Where's the why do we hold back from that? Why do we not you know, constantly dwell in a feeling of well-being and wishing well of ourselves and others. You know, so there's, I mean, there's multiple sort of layers of confusion but it's by bringing, having a conscious practice or a very clear practice to put that intention forward into consciousness and to sustain that, then that really helps to break down those tendencies to you know, either to resist or to hold back or to not be willing to establish the mind in this well-wishing. You know, we allow kind of self-view to take over, or a negative self-view. And so it's a very interesting practice, and you know, is very important for actual progress on the path, because it's that fundamental feeling of well-being that allows the heart to actually settle and become peaceful. It's that fundamental feeling of well-being that is important in having a contentment that allows us to be well established in virtue. It's that fundamental well-being that is very critical in terms of allowing the mind to not be drawn into agitation, to allow it to become clear enough to see things as they truly are, you know, which is wisdom. So it's a, you know, it's really, it really is an important foundation, and as I say, it's oftentimes undervalued or seen as something that is just you know, almost like almost like a child's practice. It's not really for grown-ups. The grown-ups get to do all the wisdom stuff and do all the sort of deal with emptiness and the analysis. But I mean, it's not possible without that fundamental steadiness of well-being. So those cultivation consciously of loving kindness is quite essential for the practice, for the training. And to do that in a structured way, to take time in each meditation to direct attention to a bringing up of that, using the thought as a seed of cultivating the feeling of loving kindness, so that just the using the traditional chant of that, may I abide in well-being, or may I be happy, may I be free from hostility, may I be free from anxiety. And to hold that, like lifting that up as a thought, and holding a thought in a space of awareness, and then being attentive to the feeling that accompanies that, and then allow the feeling of well-being to establish itself, or to be attentive to, well, what does come up when one, you know, when one brings up that thought in the mind, may I abide in well-being, or may I be happy. You know, what actually arises in the mind, just hold the space, and then allow, either to allow that feeling of well-being and happiness, security, to start to establish itself in the heart, or to recognize, well, what does come up? What does the mind do? Where is it? What sort of resistance comes up? What kind of excuses? What kind of feelings arise? So that it starts to become a bit more clear. And then can we just return to and also, you know, it's important to recognize that, you know, this wish for well-being doesn't mean that one has to be sort of gushing over with some sort of universal love for oneself and everybody. You know, it's enough to just, you know, not dwell in aversion. I mean, that's good enough. You know, can we do that? Can we not just be drawn into aversion and or doubt, you know, or self-concern, you know, in the sense that, you know, just that feeling of well-being is, you know, in the sense of is not. I mean, that's a fundamental wish for all beings, and then, you know, we tend to, you know, with a sense of self gets entangled of either evaluating, trying to find the logical excuses why one doesn't need to be doing it, or find, you know, it gets all sort of convoluted. You know, what's the convolution there? And to be able to be, you know, and just to be able to drop the convoluted processes that go on in the mind is a real act of kindness. may I abide in well-being and not have to get tied up in knots. You know? So that is working with that, you know, and that can be done in conjunction with the breath. It can be, you know, just that, because the more soothing and even the breath is, I mean, there's a calming that goes on there. That's a well-wishing, you know, bringing that feeling of well-wishing in with the breath, allowing it to suffuse the body, the heart. And then as one continues, one starts to settle, and then to extend that out to other beings. You know, may all beings. Abide in well-being. May all beings experience happiness. May all beings be free from anxiety. May all beings experience security. May all beings be free from hostility. It's sort of just extending it out, because it is a wish that all beings that we have in common. You know, we have that in common with all human beings. We have that in common with all sentient beings. And it's because of that fundamental misapprehension of reality, of avijja, ignorance, delusion, that beings don't experience it or aren't able to recognize that. So, which is the basic, you know, in the teachings of the Buddha, it's the basic cause of suffering. That avijja, not understanding truth, not understanding reality, not knowing what is true. And then desire, tanha, different kinds of desires that are complicate the mind, complicate life. So that with that, using that developing of loving kindness as a practice, really starting to highlight how avijja, ignorance, and desire work and function and do complicate things, so that that can be, one can step back from that and then return to this place of well-being and well-wishing, because it's that is a place that is let's say, where one is stepping back from the those fundamental impulses in the mind that complicate life with suffering, complicate the mind with more suffering. So that you know, it's an act of kindness to be seeing avijja, ignorance, and letting it go. It's an act of kindness to see tanha, desire, and to be letting it go. Because that's where our true well-being comes from. That's where our true sense of feeling of happiness comes from. I mean, we tend to look, end up, you know, we look for happiness in ways that tend to, you know, create more problems, create more suffering. Whereas, say, something, when one is able to establish oneself in it, you know, in true kindness to oneself, one is seeking well-being, but in a way that is not creating more suffering, more complications. So it's, you know, it's helpful to be, you know, to cultivate and nurture those qualities of loving kindness. So it really is leading one on to ways of living which are are allowing oneself to really experience a quality of freedom from suffering. And that's what we're, you know, we all want. And then also to, you know, to recognize that it's not something that one just sort of, one only does when one's you know, sitting cross-legged in meditation, or when one starts the meditation practice. It's something that one needs to be bringing into one's daily life, bringing into one's actions and speech. It's not just a mental exercise that one does when one is you know, has some quiet time for meditation, but it's something that one is really cultivating that's how we are able to act, how we're able to speak, and bringing in qualities of loving kindness. You know, I think that You know, we've all experienced, you know, being in contact with somebody or being in some situation that really moved us in a, you know, in a deep way, a profound way. And if, you know, I think that most often it's when one comes into contact with somebody who is, you know, is really embodying loving kindness, and somebody who is really, you know, unselfishly established in those qualities of goodness and caring, and that, you know, and whether it's from our parents or from our somebody close to us or some teachers or some situation where we met somebody that really changed us in some way. You think, well, that, yeah, that quality of loving kindness, you know, will certainly, I'm sure, you know, have played a large role. I mean, I think circumstances for myself of, you know, some of the things, say, like Ajahn Chah, as my teacher, they, you know, one of the qualities that he embodied that I think affected myself and affected so many others was his quality of really caring that came from this quality of kindness and of metta, loving kindness. Or, you know, for myself, I think of a time when after Ajahn Chah was ill, and he, just before he became ill, he asked me to become the abbot of Wat Nanachat, which is, you know, quite a large monastery, and with, for Westerners or for people of other nationalities. And I'd been doing it for maybe a couple of years, so Ajahn Chah had been ill for some time. And at one time I went to England for a ceremony, and then coming back to Thailand, I remember going to the airport in England okay, I'm going back to Thailand, going back to the monastery. And, you know, all that came up in my mind was just sort of depression and blackness. You know, it was just, God, it's just a fate worse than death. And, you know, how can I get out of this? And I had to, when I got to Bangkok, I was asked by one of the senior monks to take something, you know, some manuscript or something to a senior monk in Bangkok. And he's actually quite a well-known monk, and some of his stuff is translated into English now, Prapayutto. And I had never met him and didn't really heard all that much about him at that time. And I went to his temple, and it was kind of an awful temple, actually. It was on the edge of Chinatown, and very, very busy. And it was in an area, in Bangkok, the way that the city is structured, there's certain areas that have certain shops. Like you've got a whole street of monk shops, and you know, a whole sort of section. You've got Yeah, and then you've got, you know, you've got certain areas that are like the goldsmiths, and you've got certain areas. Well, this area was the place for sort of old engines and transmissions. It was the whole section of the city that was. And you had to go into his temple, you know, and with all the oil and grease coming into the streets, and it was really awful. And his temple was one of the few places in old Bangkok. It was in the very old part of Bangkok that cremations were done, and particularly cremations for people who weren't. There was a couple of places in old Bangkok for cremations, but I mean you had to have money to do it. So it was really a place for poor people to do cremation. So it was, and it had that sort of down at heel sort of look about it. And you go walking through the temple, and it's kind of. You know, it's just kind of messy and cluttered, and his dwelling place was at the back, his kuti, which was quite large, and as soon as and he was sitting there receiving some people, and it just felt, you know, as soon as you got close to him, go up into his kuti, it was just. Everything changed. It was just like stepping into a whole other realm, and it was just this quality of loving kindness. I really felt it, and he just had time for everybody, and it really without. And I sat and chatted with him, talked with him for a bit, but it was the act. What we actually talked about was. Rather inconsequential in the sense, into my mind I can't remember what we actually talked about, but I just remember the feeling and then how my mind shifted, and I felt, God, if he can survive this, mm-hmm. then, and it's just his commitment to Dhamma and his just living the teachings, and then this quality of loving kindness was so palpable. I said, oh, yeah, if you can do this, and yeah, there's hope for me. I can, okay. Because it's actually, you sort of think about it a bit more rationally. Well, I mean, everybody is very well intentioned. They're all, you know, people go to the temple, to the monastery. It's actually, on the scale of. You know, the kind of human beings that you have contact with, it's definitely on the top end of the human realm, who you meet in monasteries. You know, but you forget that. You know. So then, you know, that's really just so that sense of, that really, really inspired me and changed how I was able to take on that responsibility of being at Wat Nanachan. You know, and I'm sure that all of us have, you know, had experiences in that way. If you trace it back, you know, well, what is it that I think that quality of loving kindness is really, really an important piece. But it's sort of, you know, we need to, we need to exercise the loving kindness muscle as well. It's just learning how to bring it up, learning how to bring it into consciousness, being attentive to what the feelings that arise, and then how to. Stay with the feeling rather than going into the thinking. Because if we think, what's the point of me sitting here spreading loving kindness, the world is a mess anyway, and what's it do to the world? And you know, people have been spreading loving kindness for all these centuries, and the world's still a mess. You know, what's the point? And, you know, you go into the rational end of it, and you know, one can talk oneself out of it pretty quickly. But and certainly, you know, even the Buddha, who was kind of supreme in his cultivation of loving kindness, I mean, he still couldn't stop the world, or the, you know, at the time of the Buddha, to, you know, stop wars and people taking advantage of each other. It doesn't work that way. I mean, the world is going to do what the world does. But, you know, what are we contributing to the world, and what are we putting, what kind of position are we putting ourselves in relationship to the world? So that the, just that returning to a place of generating of attention to loving kindness, you know, gives one the opportunity to say, just be that much more at ease in the world, and then you know, that being in contact with others, the contact that we have with others, which is motivated by kindness or has that quality of loving kindness around it, it really opens opportunities for ourselves and others who have that inclination or sensitivity to begin to experience the world from that place, which is you know, it's a possibility. I think of another circumstance where, for myself, I was in conflict with a couple of monks, and really unpleasant to be in the same place with them. And it's kind of exhausted, or what I felt exhausted, my ways of dealing with them. And then, of course, at one point was reminded of the Buddha's teachings on loving kindness, and said, okay, well, that's what I'll do. I'll just walk alms round with them, and just take each moment from the beginning of the going to the on alms round, and then I'll just continue, because there, well, alms round is about an hour, hour and a half. It was a long route. It was about an hour and a half. And just use that time to generate loving kindness, and it was very interesting, because without engaging in conversation getting involved in trying to work anything out, but just through that intention and acting on that, working, just spreading that, using that whole time to be sending forth loving kindness. Within a couple days, and independent of each other, both of those monks came and asked to talk, and then trying to find a way to resolve our conflict. And I think without that willingness to establish that loving kindness, then that probably probably wouldn't have worked, or probably wouldn't have felt an opening. So that, you know, it has very practical applications, and you know, certainly the, you know, bringing it into our actions, our speech, as well as our mental cultivation of them. You know, not just as a theory, but as something that we're really trying to apply. Because that's really the kind of the glue that holds human beings together. Fear and coercion doesn't hold human beings together. Even power and advantage doesn't really hold people together. It's really that we can only sort of live together as human beings with loving kindness as a basis. Anyway, these are some thoughts of loving kindness. Offer them for reflection this evening.